our headlines. Israel arrests more relatives of several Palestinians who have recently managed to escape a high-security Israeli prison. The UN chief warns of an economic collapse in Afghanistan, calling on the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. Also, Russian energy giant Gazprom says it has finished construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas subsea pipeline to Germany. Hello, welcome to your world news, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the Israeli army has made more arrests over the Monday jailbreak of six Palestinians from a high-security prison of the regime. Two brothers and a sister of suspected mastermind Mohammed Arda were detained near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. Other relatives of the six fugitives, all from the Jenin area, were arrested on Wednesday. They are now all in detention. A massive manhunt is also underway in the occupied territories. The six Palestinians escaped from Gilboa prison through a tunnel dug beneath a sink in a cell. Israel has decided to relocate inmates following the jailbreak. Palestinian resistance factions have declared Friday a day of rage to protest the Israeli decision. Residents of Dar al-Balad in southwestern Syria have returned to their homes after a deal which led to the Syrian army taking control of the neighborhood from the armed groups. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has visited the area and filed this report.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Daraa city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. Nine checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area. The government's control over Daraa al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Daraa al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Daraa. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Daraa al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Daraa al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Daraa al-Balad, southern Syria.
Concerns are mounting over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan as funds remain frozen in the wake of the Taliban takeover of the country. The UN has warned of an economic collapse there. It says the world has a duty to extend solidarity to Afghanistan, where millions risk dying of hunger.
Fears are growing over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, where a new government is being formed under the Taliban rule, a group not yet recognized by the international community. The UN chief has called for maintaining a dialogue with the Taliban to avoid an economic collapse he says could lead to millions of deaths.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has also warned of humanitarian impacts if funds remain frozen in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of the country.
Assets and dollar and donor funds have been frozen by members of the international community. The understandable purpose is to deny these funds to the de facto Taliban administration. The inevitable effect, however, will be a severe economic downturn that could throw many more millions into poverty and hunger, may generate a massive wave of refugees from Afghanistan, and indeed set Afghanistan back for generations.
Afghanistan's neighbors are also worried about the humanitarian situation there. Iran's permanent representative to the UN says Afghanistan's dire situation is a direct result of the 20-year U.S. war there.
Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have fled their country. Nearly 600,000 of others have become internally displaced. Essential food supplies are running short, and 18.4 million people need humanitarian assistance. This situation is primarily the direct result of the intervention by the United States and other foreign forces in Afghanistan and their irresponsible withdrawal.
The U.S. fully withdrew from Afghanistan by August 31st, 2 weeks after the Taliban swept to power. The pullout ended the U.S. military presence criticized for failing to restore peace in Afghanistan. Washington is now facing calls by humanitarian groups to unfreeze funds parked in the U.S. as part of sanctions against the Taliban. Food and fuel prices are already soaring in Afghanistan amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by the U.S. halt in dollar shipments. Aid groups say the cost of economically pressuring the new Afghan rulers is the lives of millions of ordinary people already bearing the brunt of 20 years of U.S. occupation.
The United States has praised the Taliban for facilitating the first evacuation from Americans from Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrew. The White House said the departure from Kabul to Doha on chartered Qatar Airways flight marked a positive first step with the new government. It said the Taliban have been cooperative and businesslike and shown flexibility in the matter. Nearly 40 U.S. citizens or permanent residents were invited aboard the Thursday flight, but only 21 were on board. The United States had previously said a little more than 100 Americans remained in Afghanistan after Washington fully withdrew on August the 31st. The U.S. media poll says many Americans believe that events after September 11, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believed they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attacks in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11 when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. Political analyst Ian Williams says the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was disproportionate.
The reaction in Afghanistan was completely disproportionate. The small group of people who conducted these raids were, as you pointed out, more closely related to the Saudis than to the Afghans. And when the army did go in there, into Afghanistan, which allegedly was the cause and the root of the terrorists, they didn't go with huge armies. They used mercenaries. They used warlords. They used people. Well, they were used war criminals, basically. And they were paid for from CIA funds to get rid of the Taliban, while the main military force and money was spent in Iraq, which was completely unrelated. I mean, what could go wrong by hitting the wrong target with the wrong forces while, you know, and ignoring the real target?
Another anniversary of 9/11 terrorist attacks in the United States is approaching. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in response in 2001, but two decades later, Americans are seeking accountability from another country.
The United States is preparing to mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The world will probably never forget that fateful day in 2001, which changed the course of history. U.S. investigators said the Al-Qaeda terror group was behind the whole thing. America said it had evidence showing that the attacks were planned and led from inside Afghanistan. This triggered the invasion of Afghanistan that bogged down the U.S. military for 20 years. Two decades later, the family members of 9/11 victims are still struggling to find answers. They have long been pursuing accountability from another country, Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who carried out the attacks were Saudi nationals. That is not all that ties the kingdom to the complicated plot. Long classified documents have revealed that some of the hijackers had been in contact and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They also show that the phone number of then-Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was in the phone book of a close associate of Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. The families of victims said in a statement last month that evidence implicates Saudi government officials in supporting the attacks. The families have long argued that Saudis had advanced knowledge of the plot, but did nothing to stop it. The families of the victims have been pushing for the release of more 9/11 documents that successive U.S. administrations have kept secret.
Under pressure from 9/11 victim families, U.S. President Joe Biden recently signed an executive order for a declassification review of files related to the FBI's investigation. The move comes after victim families called on Biden to refrain from going to Ground Zero in New York City on the 20th anniversary unless he releases all related documents.
Biden has made up his mind about the upcoming anniversary. He will visit all three sites where hijacked planes crashed 20 years ago to commemorate the victims. But will his administration give the victim families what they've been demanding so long? They want to know for certain if Saudi Arabia aided the hijackers. Some of the still-secret files relate to an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore that focused on the two hijackers who lived in San Diego and individuals who may have assisted them. A former FBI agent who was involved in the investigation has said that he is confident that the two hijackers had a U.S.-based support network. Riyadh still denies any involvement in the 9/11 plot. It is now fighting a lawsuit brought by the families in federal court in New York. Why have successive U.S. governments been reluctant to release the files so many years after the horrific event?
It has been a mystery why the U.S. has been covering up for connections to Saudi Arabia throughout these last 20 years. So that's why the 9/11 families have had their lawsuit and tried through the courts to get access to this information. But, you know, it's not just the 9/11 families. The entire public of the United States deserves to know what happened on 9/11 and before 9/11, deserves to know what connections the U.S. has been covering up for.
U.S. authorities have argued that any release of more files could result in damage to the national security. But some observers believe Saudi lobbies in America could have played a role in blocking the very long-awaited release. Top U.S. officials also seem reluctant to sour lucrative ties between America and the autocratic kingdom by thoroughly investigating the clues about possible Saudi government involvement in 9/11 events.
The close relationship that the U.S. government has with Saudi Arabia has made it very difficult for the 9/11 families to get the access to the information they deserve and they need to prosecute the case that has been going on for 20 years against the 9/11 hijackers.
Will the Biden administration, which has promised more transparency, act differently?
Russian energy giant Gazprom says it has finished construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas subsea pipeline to Germany. The Russian company began the project 5 years ago, but the progress was halted in 2019 when former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions against the project. Parts of the measures targeted vessels involved in the project. Russia resumed the construction of the pipeline earlier this year with the engagement of its own vessels. Nord Stream 2 will double Russia's gas exporting capacity to Europe via the Baltic Sea. It will also allow Moscow to bypass Ukraine. Following Gazprom's announcement, Kiev said it will fight the project. Official data shows that Britain's economic recovery slowed sharply in July despite further lifting of coronavirus restrictions. Britain's Office for National Statistics said gross domestic product output grew by only 0.1% in July. It marked the sixth straight month of economic growth. However, the increase was much lower compared to the 1% growth in June. The recovery stalled amid rising COVID cases and worker shortages. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a tax rise on workers and employers to fix a health and social care funding crisis. Following the announcement, a poll showed that public support for the ruling Conservative Party slipped by five points to 33%. That's the party's biggest slump since 2019. Chinese President Xi Jinping says U.S. policies towards Beijing have caused, quote, serious difficulties in their bilateral ties. Xi made the comment in a phone call with his American counterpart, Joe Biden. The Chinese president called for putting ties back on track. He said that's critical for the future and the destiny of the world. Biden made it clear that Washington welcomes competition, but does not want it to lead to conflict. That's according to a senior official of his administration. The official said the goal of the phone conversation was to set out, quote, guardrails to ensure that relations can be managed responsibly. Ties have been soured between China and the U.S. in the past several years over a number of issues, including trade and security. Australia's new daily COVID infections have surged past 1,900. That marks the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. New South Wales reported over 1,500 of the new cases. The southeastern state is the epicenter of the current outbreak in Australia. That's the worst outbreak there. It began in mid-July and has been fueled by the highly infectious Delta variant. The rest of the new daily cases were logged in Victoria state. Both Victoria and New South Wales have been under lockdown for weeks now to curb the virus spread. Authorities are now planning to ease some restrictions over the next few weeks as they are nearing the target of inoculating residents.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Was never a colony, but it marks anti-British colonialism day each year on Shahrivar the 12th, which fell to September the 3rd this year. The day is a reminder of a potent British presence in Iran while commemorating efforts to thwart imperialist influence in this country by tribal fighters. It's the martyrdom anniversary of Rais Ali Delvari, who organized popular resistance in the south against British troops which had invaded Iran in 1915. In other words, Iran felt their boot even without the British being resident imperialism in this country. They first set their sights on Iran in the 19th century. But whenever something isn't quite right, Iranians suspect British involvement. Is it just paranoia based on a past reality, or is the past present? And are the British still policymakers, or do they simply follow a U.S. policy of hostility and destruction in Iran and West Asia? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. the British, generally fair in court and chatty over a cuppa, can't boast their ancestors left the same impression when they ventured out as a modern power. World War I saw a neutral Iran occupied by British, Russian, and Ottoman forces, with the Brits emptying this country of grain in the name of feeding their soldiers and the sort. About 10 million Iranians starved to death or were driven to deadly illness between 1917 and 1919. A massacre. The country's total population had been no more than 30 million. This trend of any means justifying the end continued into World War II and beyond, into the 1950s. Mr. Jalilvand is a British affairs analyst. He gave us an enlightened interview in the studio in his humble fashion before admitting to his postdoctorate degree from Oxford.
After World War II, the decline of the British Empire began. If you pay attention, the secession of India in 1949, the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran in 1953, and the nationalization of the Suez Canal in 1956 by Jamal Abdel Nasser marked the decline of the British Empire, which was 30 million square kilometers. It controlled such a vast expanse in its territory. But World War I and World War II, 25 years apart, weakened Britain and helped oppressed nations free themselves of British yoke.
The recent choice of British ambassador to this country did not help with Iranians' impression of Brits in politics. Simon Shercliffe has been a high-up intelligence serviceman. He was actually director for national security at the Foreign Office from February 2018. What never dies in Iranian minds was portrayed in a whole TV series which just ended this week on Sunday, September the 5th. Gondo portrays British meddling in this country to the point of menacing by drawing on real-life characters. Some TV critics say the series is too distant from facts on the ground and has sunk into fiction. All the same, it does trace a historic reality of the British presence, otherwise known as the English job. Mr. Shercliffe's reaction to the film is interesting. He says he utterly enjoys Gondo 2 anyway. And so, Iran's national TV chief, Ali Askari, suggested the British government broadcast the spy series on the BBC. Mr. Ahmadi has watched the series as though studying it. Mr. Ahmadi is an analyst who did us the honors of coming to Press TV Studios. Let's hear him share his views with us.
In the Gondo series, the main takeaway is, now that Americans aren't in Iran, the British are doing the Americans and the Western bloc's bidding in Iran, especially regarding a soft influence in the country's economy, politics, and also Iran's border issues and helping the separatists.
The said spy thriller series, Gondo 2, focuses on individuals spying for Britain and shows Iran's security apparatus detecting and neutralizing MI6 agents' plans to undermine this country's sovereignty. We are talking hostile plans that didn't subside, but apparently peaked over the past 10 years. Gondo is a small crocodile indigenous to southeastern Iran, cunning and agile in hunting its prey.
The structure of the MI6 is different. If you refer to the book British Wage Earners in Iran, it names people that would astound you. They've been developing such a network for quite some time. It's been underway since the Qajar period and is now being directed by Freemasons and others. Many believe that the British have been behind most of the events happening in Iraq.
Some cases of British espionage or sabotage I'll mention throughout the program, as will our show guests. The story Gondo begins with transferring someone detained across the border, a reminder of a like incident last year. And Mohammed, the hero, visits a border town to look into the case of a spy fanning the flames between Shia and Sunni. Along the line, he finds clues to links between Iran's nuclear deal negotiators and foreign powers, especially Britain.
I think these were people who wanted to have good ties with the British government, and that's why they entered into a deal with them, although subconsciously. They thought that they'd provide the British with information and they'd receive some favors in return. The favors could be either personal or, as they thought, could be in line with Iran's national interests. We're facing both scenarios. That's why I'm not saying that they were ill wishes. Some of them think they're working for Iran's national interests as they're promoting reconciliation and making a deal between the two sides. But the British officials look at this differently. They deem it as a way of support. Iranian officials also look at this as cooperation and collaboration with foreigners.
There are no real names provided, but as the story develops, we get to know Ibrahim Sharif, Musa Purhadi Sabunchi, Abdul Rasul Ashrafi, and Bahadur Karimi, who are present at the talks directly or indirectly to submit Iran's confidential economic and political information to foreign parties. Many media outlets, in matching the film characters to real-life cases, discovered the real people they resemble, who are either detained, convicted, or on the run. Whether verdicts will overturn is another matter.
Because the United States cannot enter Iran easily, it has to use British agents or some nationals of other countries. The British are much more experienced than the Americans, especially because of their long-running studies of Iran and their experiences with the Iranians since the 19th century, and their agents who have been active in Iran for many years, both before and after the Islamic Revolution.
The series, which is directed by Javad Afshar and written by Arash Ghaderi, believes even currency rate fluctuations over the past 4 years are down to British ringleading and some possibly former central bank managers. It explains how the British embassy grips onto one of the managers to assimilate four of his affiliates in that sensitive bank. And then it starts engineering currency market rates to increase the price of foreign currency. Not to point a finger at any individual, but this state of the economy would cause dissatisfaction and unrest in the country.
We even see that concerning economic matters, including Iran's financial and exchange markets, Iran's assets abroad and the like. Britain needs accurate information in line with the interests of the US about how Iran copes with sanctions, for example, and that's why they use these kinds of people. Some might call it espionage, but words don't change the facts. We're seeing them as documented facts.
The exchange rates are engineered by supply management and psychological warfare. Charlotte, a high-ranking MI6 agent, maintains a physical presence in the currency market to accompany embassy affiliates in messing up the Iranian market.
The Western capitalist world is a closely integrated one. They might disagree on some topics, but they act in unison. According to Karl Marx, capitalism lacks two factors. One is religion, and the other a homeland. It has a global status. Britain was the driving force of the capitalist system for years. It's now left that to the US and retired to the back seat, but it continues to retain its influence and policies in West Asia. I'm certain that it has deep influences in all West Asian countries and has expertly laid out its chess pieces there.
The UK also has a long-standing entanglement with Iran, as does the USA. It was cut off from Iran, like the United States, by the Islamic Revolution, but Britain felt sore long before the revolution, when in the 1950s, Iran nationalized its oil. The US may have been pleased Britain's pipeline to Iranian oil was severed, but the British got America to help them retaliate with what's known as the 1953 coup that toppled the oil nationalization era government in Iran. Iranians to this day hold a grudge against both countries for their interference. And Brits and Americans just can't bear to let go of their seemingly loosening grip on this region. Not that the method has to make sense. Mr. Tabrizi is a historian we met at Ebrat Museum. The prison is a reminder of torture by Savak, the intelligence service, during the Shah's time. So I had to ask if an imperialist Britain and capitalist US could have had anything to do with physical torture.
Colonialism is colonialism. It's colonial in nature. The colonizers aren't enemies, they're friends. There might be some rivals between them, but that's as long as they want to dominate a region. If nations wake up, they will also unite. For example, during the constitutional revolution in Iran circa 1906, the nation won. But we see that in 1907, the Russian and British divided Iran among themselves. That's why they were both rivals. The Russians wanted to colonize Iran with their 1919 deal. If the deal had been implemented, the 1921 coup and ascension of Reza Khan to the throne would have not taken place, because Rusuvoddole and the members of the Lodge of Awakening would have done that. But when the deal broke down, their objective switched to changing the government and its structure.
And so the plot and fight continues, as is hinted at in Gonjo. Britain appears to be complementing U.S. hostile actions against Iran and other countries in the region. For example, the United States has not fought in any war in the Middle East without Britain. The U.K. and U.S. may be secret rivals, but they can't do without one another to hold on. Britain noticeably appears desperate to keep in with America since Brexit in 2020.
On the other hand, the Americans don't have the experience that the British do in Iran and the region, and they need a network of accurate geographical and ethnic information about Iran. They want to know about Iranians' habits and characteristics. They need to have relations with Iran's foreign opposition and other issues, which we mainly call soft power.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
The so-called wars of 9/11, 20 years later, don't appear to have met any ends, never mind fulfilling evidently false premises they were based on. Twin Towers and an Al-Qaeda explosion? To this day, no one knows for certain it wasn't an inside job. The British and American people have also had enough of these senseless wars. In 2015, YouGov revealed that support for West Asia or Middle East intervention had collapsed from two-thirds to one-third since 2003. A similar fall from 63% to 38% were recorded by YouGov America. By November 2019, the U.S. had spent under $6.5 trillion on almost two decades of wars with more than 7,000 military dead. Britain had lost over 630. The justification was not satisfying. There's plenty more to relate from history and on current affairs, and we will return with what we've time for. But in the meantime, a quick media review indoors to see what other outlets have to say. And here's how the news words it. The Financial Tribune reads, collective efforts free from foreign meddling key to regional stability. President Ebrahim Raisi stressed the importance of solving issues in the region through dialogue, saying neighborly cooperation free from foreign interference is a prerequisite for regional stability and security. Cooperation and synergy among regional countries without foreign interference are prerequisites for regional stability and security, the establishment of peace in countries of the region and welfare of its nations, Raisi said in a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein in Tehran. Iran believes that dialogue among regional countries aimed at finding solutions to the existing problems and improving relations would promote security and stability, while foreign meddling in the region's affairs would increase tensions, he stressed. Tasnim News points to nuclear deal talks.
Iran not to allow JCPOA talks to feature irrelevant issues. A high-ranking Iranian diplomat said Tehran would resolutely stand by its assertion that neither the JCPOA talks nor the nuclear deal are allowed to feature any irrelevant subject matter, such as Iran's defensive missile program or its regional influence. Kazem Alibabadi, Iran's permanent ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, made the remarks in an interview reflecting on a warning issued by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about the West's intention to use the 2015 nuclear deal to enable interference in the country's affairs. The U.S. left the agreement, which is officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018. It then reimposed the inhumane sanctions that the deal had partially lifted and started forcing other countries into abiding by the coercive economic measures, too. Its threesome European allies in the accord, the UK, France, and Germany, were quick to align themselves with Washington's new approach. In a move pointed out by the leader, they have been trying to advance a provision that that could pave the way for their meddling in the Islamic Republic's affairs. And that would be it for this segment. Do stay tuned. If the Brits and Americans continue with hopeless wars because of an illusion of colonial grandeur from a time past, Iran is known as the world's first empire, a benevolent empire, 2,500 years ago. Yet it doesn't go capturing weaker countries because of some delusion of what can be.
Since Fath Ali Shah's rule, we have witnessed the betrayals, troublemaking, and crimes of the British in Iran. The British were to blame for one of the betrayals against Iran during the Iran-Russia war. They're the ones who separated Herat from Iran and deployed troops in Bushehr and committed crimes there.
Since after Iran's Islamic Revolution, the UK has always acted in hostile fashion. For example, in 1980, the country cut ties with Tehran, mostly due to the US embassy takeover in November 1979, and closure of that embassy at the request of Washington itself. The Den of Spies, as Iran named that embassy. An attack on the Iranian embassy in London won't have come as a total surprise. Soon after the US embassy, the UK closed its Tehran mission. Around the same time, the Iranian embassy in London was forcefully occupied by a group of six anti-Islamic Republic pan-Arabist gunmen. They identified themselves with the Democratic Revolutionary Front for the Liberation of Arabistan, DRFLA, which actually meant Iran's Khuzestan province of Persians and Arabs. It was perceived to be a Carter-Thatcher conspiracy executed by Iraqi hands.
This has been the usual MO of the British since World War II to support minorities in different countries to pressure the others. This leaves those regional countries in a perpetual state of weakness and tension. When the UK throws its weight behind a minority in some countries to get to power, for example in Bahrain, the minority needs backing to stay in power. This makes them dependent on London in the long run.
British influence, or Britain's pan-American influence, doesn't have to be direct. It has the UN to wield as its weapon, especially with America at its side. And so it can support and prop up all anti-Iranian plans and sanctions in the United Nations and likes.
In defining colonialism, we say it has had three stages. The first was the old colonialism, like the military occupation of India by the British government. The second is neo-colonialism, like bringing to power Reza Khan in Iran, Ataturk in Turkey, and Faisal in Iraq. In this type of colonialism, they actually bring in their own people. There's also a trans-colonialism that starts from international institutions, media, and universities. This is a type of colonialism the U.S. is at the forefront. It's the neo-colonists' move to fight back.
Another means of indirect meddling in Iranian affairs is supporting wannabe overthrowers of the Islamic Republic, sheltering separatists and monarchists. At the other end of the overthrowing spectrum, we've also got the MEK. Now, the MEK is a whole different story. Otherwise known as the hypocrites, they are heavily armed, and they're a cult-like terror group that fought alongside Iraq against Iran in the 1980s. Traitors, so to speak.
And these groups don't just exist. They're voiced by anti-Iranian Persian language opposition news networks launched by or allowed to be launched by the UK in the UK. Iran International is one. It is owned by Volent Media that has a director named Adil Abdulkarim, who is a Saudi national and known to put Saudi funds behind the channel. Now, this channel began operating in 2017 when relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia were sore. BBC Persian TV, on the other hand, was launched in mid-January 2009, just months before the post-election riots in Iran. Could be just a coincidence. It's in the name of freedom of expression that the UK has become a safe haven for groups opposing the Islamic Republic. Hence, the launching of set channels and moving around money by Iranians of the opposition.
Since Britain created the BBC radio years ago, it's been gathering opponents of Iran and training them. I don't want to talk about conspiracy theories that I personally believe in, but the BBC is funded by the British government. The outlet claims to be working independently, but it receives funding from the government. The vast majority of its employees are like George Orwell, who was a spy and worked for the BBC. A majority of them have ties with intelligence services in West Asia and other regions of the world. Naturally, when London opposes a country, it will gather their opposition members and provides them with services.
It's no secret the UK has blocked Iran's access to its assets. It was reported in 2009 to have frozen $1.64 billion in Iranian assets, actually, under the EU and UN sanctions against Iran. The UN Security Council imposed three sets of sanctions on this country between 2006 and 2009 over its nuclear program. While Tehran said its program was designed only to generate electricity, I asked if withholding blocked Iranian money is the UK's own decision or if it is waiting for a green light from the USA before it releases the funds. A lot more money has safely crept into the UK from Iran, so the question holds.
Britain has had trade relations with Iran for years after the Islamic Revolution. It can claim that it can't return Iran's funds because we no longer have trade ties because of the sanctions. This claim isn't valid. The UK has had trade relations with Iran for decades, even after the Islamic Revolution. Also, after the JCPOA was signed, all sanctions were lifted in the first couple of years, giving the UK the chance to pay back what it owed, but it didn't.
UK intervention has, of course, not always been indirect. In fact, it has been physically hostile on occasion, as recently as just over 2 years ago. The UK illegally detained a tanker carrying Iranian oil in international waters, claiming it was transporting oil to Syria in violation of the EU sanctions. That was on July the 4th, 2019, years after the 2015 nuclear deal, which it violated.
In 2019, Britain embarked on an adventure in the Mediterranean Sea. It seized an Iranian tanker that was carrying Iranian oil to West Asia. It was later revealed that this was done at the request of the United States. Iran could not get its oil tanker back through negotiations. This was while no international law allowed such a seizure. After a while, Iran demonstrated a strong reaction to this, forcing the UK to release the tanker. This shows the decline of Britain's hard power. It also indicated the US influence in issues related to ties between Iran and the UK.
British meddling here began two centuries ago. Whether it will go on much longer is not known. To see where Anglo-Iranian relations will lead and hear all else that's to be known about Iran, tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Until then, bye.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have...
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك.
يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards sincerity and spirituality, the one who has eloquently said, if a person alleviates the sadness and troubles of a believer, Allah will turn away the sadness and troubles of this life and the next from him. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words with al-Farazdaq.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام صدقت لله الأمر كل يوم هو في شأن إن نزل القضاء بما نحب ونرضى فنحمد الله على نعمائه وهو المستعان على أداء الشكر وإن حال القضاء دون الرجاء فلم يتعد من كان الحق نيته والتقوى سريرته.
You have said the truth for the sake of Allah, and every day he manifests himself in yet another wondrous way. If destiny goes with what we favor and desire, we will praise Allah for his bounties, and he is the helper for us to discharge this gratitude. And if destiny denied the hope, such a person whose intention was right and piety had been their inward disposition, they have not gone astray.
As-salamu alayka ya asir al-kurbayat. As-salamu alayk ya السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب السلام على الخد التريب
السلام
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, abin nasta'in. Assalamu alayki, Abu Abdullah. In the context of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam leaving the city of Mecca toward al-Kufa, as soon as Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam got out of the city of al-Kufa, he encountered al-Farazdaq. And al-Farazdaq was a great and noble man in the Arab community, and he was a great and renowned poet. Then when Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to leave Mecca, and at the same time, while he was leaving Mecca, I mean the Haram, the greater sacred region of Mecca, at that time he noticed that, I mean, many people were coming inside the sacred realm of Mecca. And among those people, there was certainly al-Farazdaq. Al-Farazdaq was a noble Arab poet. Then al-Farazdaq got astonished why, when almost all people rushed toward the sacred region of Mecca, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was coming out of the city of Mecca. Then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it to him that he was resolute in his movement, and if the currents of change are in favor of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he would certainly be grateful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He would certainly be thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who enables a people to thank him. And from this we understand that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was giving a delicate lesson in the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in at-tawheed to al-Farazdaq. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that in case he finds that the currents of change go contrary to the initial expectation of him, he would certainly like whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala likes for him. From this we understand that this kind of delicate lesson in a tawheed, in a practical tawheed, forms the basic philosophy of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam's movement, contrary to many revolutions in which people who get involved in the revolution usually anticipate to be provided with some opportunity after the victory of the revolution. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that he always intended to receive the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and this Tawheed-based approach in the movement of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam forms the basic philosophy of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam's movement. From this, we understand that the whole movement of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam was nothing but receiving the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is a sense of practical Tawheed. Assalamu alaykum, Ya Abu Abdullah.
Assalamu alaykum.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Husayn today and always.
عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقي وبقي الليل والنهار.
What you heard
was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.